My name is Amy Pond. When I was 7, I had an imaginary friend. Last night was the night before my wedding, and my imaginary friend came back and back.
All of time and space, everything that ever happened or ever will. Where do you want to start?
Anywhere you want. Any time you want. One condition, it has to be amazing.
It starts. Because this is what I do. Every time, every day, every second. This. Hold tight.
Because it will change your life.
There's one thing you never put in a trap if you're smart. If you value your continued existence. If you have any plans about seeing tomorrow, there's one thing you never, ever put in a trap.
Me.
It's a trap.
Day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 145 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
And what's been happening since our seventh birthday episode? You've two been whoring yourself out on all sorts of podcasts, haven't you? Did you do so? Would you record something that you mentioned had gone online sometime today, Hayden?
Yeah, so one of my best friends and best man at my wedding, Mr. James Briginshaw, who'd also been on a few episodes of the Podcasters Royale with yourself and Doc and myself, he's got a podcast with a friend of his called Chris Holt called The Lunch Hour Geek Out. They invited me on an episode of theirs to talk about guilty pleasures. So we spoke about our guilty pleasures in TV, film and music.
Oh, yes, of course, because you were... I remember you agonising with Mark and myself before you went on, saying, there aren't any Doctor Who stories that I feel guilty about loving. That's why Hayden, his top five picks synchronised almost exactly with the final results, because he's just so nice, he's like everyone else. I was like, Mark and I, we're the real rebels, aren't we, Mark?
I'm not so sure this time, but okay.
No, I'm not so sure either.
Anything else been happening?
I've actually been... Do you remember last year where I was doing my Doctor Who rewatch?
Yes.
I got to season 3 and watched that condensed episode of Galaxy 4 and then kind of gave up on the Hartnell rewatch and just thought, well, I'll just watch what exists. Which basically meant that I missed quite a lot of that season. Then I remembered that here in the Whoseum, we have a complete collection of the Doctor Who Target novels. Apart from the Web of Fear, which for some reason is somewhere else, I'm not sure where it is. But anyway. So I've started reading the William Hartnell Target books. And I actually started with The Time Meddler, which I know exists, but I love that story. So I read that over the weekend. And starting this morning, I started reading The Mythmakers.
Oh, right.
By Donald Cotton, which is an interesting novelization, and I think partly inspired to read this by the latest DWM issue about the Target books, the new imprint that's coming out. And I did read that compendium of the new Target books that are coming out that was free with the magazine. And then I thought I'll read The Mythmakers, and it's very interesting because it's all told from the perspective of one character. Anyway, I won't spoil it if you haven't read it before. But yeah, it's all right so far. Just got up to the bit when Stephen encounters Vicky and Troy, and they are put to death. But yeah, going well so far.
It's a great story. I love Mythmakers.
Yes, that was one of whose favourite was that? I think that was one of the favourites of Al Noe, our former host was a big fan of Mythmakers.
Yeah, it would have been in my top five as well.
Yeah, I remember it being quite high on Mark's list. Yeah, and it is a pity. You're right, Doc.
The other thing that's happened to me is that, quite surprisingly, I've, despite being only in my early 50s and not really in any at-risk group, I've already had my first COVID-19 vaccine jab.
Oh!
Came as quite a surprise. On the first Saturday of February, I received a text message out of the blue inviting me to book my first jab by following this link. And I thought, they'll be offering me some dates in April or May or something. Instead of which, they offered me a choice of 3 slots the next day.
Wow.
There was a button to click for alternative dates, but when I clicked that, it didn't produce any. And when I went along the next day, it was mostly pensioners in the queue. So I suspect that what must have happened is that they've got a supply of the vaccine, which maybe had to be used up by a certain date. Yeah. Perhaps they were due to receive a brand new supply on Monday and they needed to clear the space, as much space in their freezers as possible. And they'd run out of oldies. So this has invitations to lower risk groups to fill up the spaces.
Oh, how was it?
It was interesting. You join a queue. It's, usually some volunteers with their clipboards come forward and ask you your name. And then they go off to a desk and give you a sort of pre-printed form with your name on. They put you in front of a big poster saying, do you answer yes to any of these questions? It's like, this is my first jab. I have severe allergic reactions to vaccinations or something. I have a high fever or whatever. And then they tick off your various answers on the paper, give it to you. You go into a cubicle where they check your name and they ask, do you want to see your right bicep, your left bicep, your right thigh, your left thigh? I said, oh, just the nearest one, please. And then they give you a little card with your name on and the type of vaccine you got and saying this person had their first injection on this date. And I think you put it in your wallet and then you presumably present it when you get called up for your second one. And then they sort of direct you towards a seating area where they ask you to just sit down for about 15 minutes, presumably just in case you have a severe allergic reaction so there can be people around to help you. And then they sort of wave you away. And apart from a slight numbness in my arm, like you get when you have a flu jab or something, I've been fine, really.
Well, I'm glad you didn't take any notice of those anti-vaxxers saying that Bill Gates has been putting microchips in it. Have there been any side effects?
Oh, I think that is so ridiculous. Why on earth would Bill Gates want to control my life by inventing a pandemic so that he could get me injected with a vaccine? So that I can be secretly injected with a microchip. It wasn't. It's just you really shouldn't give credence to these anti-vaxxer conspiracies. Mm. I had my jab about 2 weeks ago and I haven't felt any side effects.
Oh, lovely.
Other than the fact that since I've had it, my farts sound slightly different now. So I hope you'll forgive me, faithless sisters, if you hear me let rip once or twice during this podcast, but it's beyond my control.
How do you mean that your farts sound different?
Oh, just different, really. I don't think it's anything to do with Bill Gates, though. In fact, oh, here comes one now.
Well, no, that seems perfectly normal.
Sounds fine to us, eh? Sorry, Mark, can you open the window?
Sorry.
Thank you. Yeah, actually, I do wonder whether it could possibly be because of your standing in society as a doctor.
Do you think so?
Perhaps. I know you're only qualified to work on sailors, but maybe.
Well, I must admit, there were a lot of people in there cosplaying as Ben.
With HMS Caesar on there.
So, anything else interesting been going on? News you got about your cot, Hayden. I missed that picture of a cot you sent us.
Sorry?
Cot.
I thought you said
unsolicited cot pics.
Just double check something.
See what I keep saying about the importance of properly voicing your dentals?
Yeah, no, we're 3 weeks away from due date. If actually a little less than that, we're about 2.5 weeks away from due date now. So it's all getting incredibly real, and I sent a picture of the cot that myself and Sophie constructed of beside me crib.
Oh, yeah, I thought the due date was tallied with a very auspicious date in the history of the podcast, which is my birthday.
It is, yes. Yes, it is, yeah.
I've already got your card, Mark.
Oh, got my card marked.
I've got two related ones, and I can't think which one to send you yet. So. What's the date again?
12th of March.
Yes, indeed it is.
Oh, it's not far away, is it? Right, well, faithless sisters, we have finally got to...
Very nice of Mark to share it, to be honest with you. It's very kind of him.
We have finally got to our 11th Doctor retrospective, in which we look back at the Matt Smith era. What happened, as those of you who know us best will know, is that round about, I think it was between Christmas and New Year, we sent out an invitation on social media for you all to send in votes for your top five Matt Smith stories. Now, whether that's your top five personal favourites or the ones you think are the top five best made or produced ones, it's up to you. We don't really mind. Main rules are that two-parter stories like Time of Angels, Flesh and Stone, or Pandorica Opens, The Big Bang count as one story.
Can I just say one thing that really annoys me about the Russell T. Davies and the Stephen Moffat era is that all the two-parters have individual episode titles. Well, I know obviously they used to be in the Hartnell pair, but it's just... The one thing I'm very happy about the Christian Lirio is that he started doing parts one and two, because when you're typing these out, it's so tedious to have to keep typing out two titles for everything. And you think about how much climate damage is done by computer servers all around the globe. And I just think that Moffat and Davis has really added to it.
I'm not aware that he was doing parts one and two, Chibnall, is he?
Yeah, Spyfall was.
Oh, yes, that's one. Was there any others?
That's been it so far, hasn't it? Oh, no. You know, there has been a two-part. Ascension of the Cybermen and the Timeless Children.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was the
other. Well, he's just as bad as everyone else then. I knew it.
One debate that we did have several people asking us was, does the 50th anniversary special, Day of the Doctor, count as a Matt Smith story, or are we keeping it separate? And we thought... Well, if we did that, wouldn't we have to say that the Three Doctors, the Two Doctors, the Five Doctors, any other story that's got the multi-doctor stories would have to go out again. So it's said that the Day of the Doctor counts as a Matt Smith story.
I think that would be an ecumenical matter.
Oh, do you know what? That really, really winds me up that people don't think it's a part of his era. I mean, for God's sakes, he's the incumbent Doctor at the point. Just don't understand it. Do you know what? Next time, if we ever do David Tennant at some point, I'm just going to go for my top five of him is going to be Dreamland, Attack of the Grask, that appearance with John Barrowman on Tonight's the Night, the scene in Extras, just to f off all of the 10th Doctor fans who want Silence in the Library at number one or something. It's clearly it really bugs me. When we do Troughton, is the Two Doctors going to go in there? Just to, you know, please some Colin Baker fans. No. It's part of his era. Shut up.
Dear.
But I would say, I mean, for me, I didn't vote it in my top five. And this is a personal choice. Because I feel it's like the Lance Armstrong of Doctor Who stories. It's it's like financially doped, isn't it? By being the 50th episode. Yeah.
It's the Manchester City of the Matt Smith era.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the one that many of us will have remembered watching in the cinema on 3D as well. Financial doping.
Yeah, so it's got such a huge advantage. I don't know. For me, I love it, obviously, but I just kind of think it's its own thing. I know what you're saying, Hayden, and I appreciate that, but for me, it's its own thing, and I don't... Because there's so much else going on with it, I can't vote for it purely as a Matt Smith story.
Do you know what, though? That kind of means you can't ever vote for a Hinchcliffe story.
Huh?
Because of his era is so financially doped in comparison to the Graham Williams era.
Oh, well, I'm not just talking about the...
Oh, here we go. Stuff,
but
here we go.
Not many of those Hinchcliffe stories have guest stars the caliber of John Hurt appearing in them as the Doctor.
They had John Woodnut. What more do you want?
Hayden does have a point. I think it was really unfair of Philip Hinchcliffe to hire really good writers.
Yeah.
During the really good writers and directors and producers during those first three seasons. It's quite scandalous.
I mean, the Talon should never have been in our top five because it was financially doped with the money from next year's budget. On that sort of economical thinking.
Well, yeah, but like I say, it's not purely that thinking. It's just the fact that its position as like the 50th anniversary story and everything. I mean, it goes without saying that it's going to be, and it was, one of the best Doctor Who stories made. And it's got this very special place. But I still, for me, don't see it as just like a Matt Smith story. I can see your point of view, Hayden.
I just think if you expel it from the list, you're asking for trouble.
I'm not suggesting it should be expelled from the list. I just made a personal decision not to support Man City. I mean, not to have it in my top five.
Well, that wasn't the only ecumenical. Do I mean ecumenical? Denominational?
I've no idea. I don't really know what it means.
Wasn't the only sectarian dispute we had? That Rick Moran, that notorious trouble causer, wasn't prepared to give us a top one unless we allowed him to vote for Sarah Jane Adventure's story, Death of the Doctor. But we had to put our foot down. In the end, I had a quiet word with Tony Jordan, and Rick backed down.
Sounds a bit sinister. What did he do?
So, as normal, as usual with these retrospectives, Faith and Sisters, you were giving us your top five. Your first place story was given 5 points. Your second place story, 4 points. Third place story, 3 points. Fourth place story, 2 points. And fifth place story was given 1 point. And then we totted those all up to give totals. And the final votes were still coming in only a couple of hours ago this afternoon. But we finally have them. Now, finally, it's been a while since we've been able to do this, but at the bottom of the list, there are 7 stories which gained no points whatsoever.
Wow!
You know what? I'm sorry, I am surprised.
That surprises me, because we had a fair number of votes, didn't we, so far?
It was 8 until your Polly voted this afternoon, Mark.
Oh, yes, I can... See, she's taken after her old man, hasn't she? Yeah. She's put something unpredictable in at number 2.
Was it Nymon?
So do the two of you want to take turns at guessing one?
Yes,
see how many you can get. And then Mark now says Dave the
Doctor.
The
winner wins 4-3, essentially, don't they? Yeah, okay,
yeah.
Brilliant.
Should we toss a... No, let's not bother tossing a coin. I'll let her end up finding the coin tosser sound effect. Mark, would you like to make a first guess?
Oh, yes. I guess Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS.
No.
Right, I'm walking off.
That is quite shocking, isn't it? But don't worry, the people who have voted for Journey... Who voted for Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS? Let's have a look.
We're going to find you, and we're going to come over to your house and cut off your electricity.
Oh, someone put us in fifth place.
Oh, fair enough.
And someone put us in fourth.
Before I make my guess, I just want to say I'm just joking. I do actually really love it when people find things in Doctor Who that they love in stories that just aren't rated. Unless you're Mark, of course.
Yeah, I was going to say. It's
we shan't reveal who voted for them, but no, Jesus says the TARDIS did not get 0 points. Hayden?
Nightmare in Silver's got to be in there, surely.
Nightmare in Silver got 0 points.
Hey.
It came joint 33rd.
Oh, okay. Right, okay.
Wow.
Mark.
Oh, God. Crimson Horror.
No, not at all. Hayden, your girl?
The Beast Below.
Would you believe no?
Oh, hey. Well.
Mark?
Well, maybe I'll speak about that. But,
Oh, I've got one, which I know will be in there, surely.
Closing Time.
Yes, that's in there.
Closing.
Yes.
So, semi-sonic.
One all.
The rings of a carton.
Would you believe no?
Oh, this is tragic so far.
Someone, I won't mentioning no names, puts in second place.
Mark.
No! It's not me!
Mark?
Okay. I'm gonna go for Doctor the Widow and the Wardrobe.
Would you believe no?
What? The hell's going on?
Do you know what? With the way this is going, I'm just gonna come out and say it. Vincent and the Doctor.
No, Mark, you'll go.
Unpredictable list. Great for the podcast, yeah, but at the I same love time.
It. Oh, The Curse of the Black Spot.
That's in there, yes. Oh.
2-1.
Aiden?
Let's have a think. Oh, Let's Kill Hitler.
No, that's not in there.
Of course it isn't. Of course it isn't.
Why would it be? Night Terrors.
Yes, that's in there. Oh, 3-1 to Mark.
Okay. Do you know what? I don't think it's because that's a particularly bad episode either. I think it's because it's just one of those ones that nobody's likely to remember or put in their top five.
But if you could also ask about the Doctor the Widow and the Wardrobe, couldn't you? You still got a vote.
Oh, yeah.
Aiden?
I'm going to say Victory of the Daleks.
Yes. There's one that none of you will ever get. Right, there's two left. One is from the first series, and the other is from the last series.
Dinosaurs on the Spaceship.
Nope. Aiden? One's a two-parter.
One's a two-parter. Oh, hang on. One's a two-parter from the first or second series. First or third series.
Oh, that rather gives it away, isn't it?
Okay, yeah, that has completely given it away because there's no two-parters in Series 7, so it can only be, and I don't think, that's as mad as this list is so far, I don't think the Pandorica Opens will be in the bottom. Pointless. I don't think that Time of Angels will be either. So, by process of elimination, it's got to be The Hungry Earth and Cold Blood.
It has.
Right.
3-3. So, you've got one chance to go ahead, Mark. So, give it a good thought. I'll just put some music on. Okay.
We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx, and Staten Island, too.
Hang on, this is the clue. You're giving away the clue.
No, just put some music on at random, Hayden. Have you thought of one yet, Mark?
Is it the 11th hour?
No. I was going to say Day of the Doctor.
Is it The Angels Take Manhattan?
Look how he pulled that out of his iron out of the fire.
No, look, can I just tell you, I was going to go for A Town Called Mercy, actually. But for some reason, I felt inspired at the last second.
4-3 to Mark. Oh, very close, though. Right, we had a splendid response this time.
Unbelievable.
72 people voted, including the three of us, giving a total points tally of 1,080 points.
Whoa.
And having just knocked off the first 7 of those, that means that we're starting at number 31. And is Smashy around? Are you there, Smashy? Would you like to start the countdown?
I certainly am, great mate. Right, number 31, we've got that Rebel Flesh and the Almost People on 1 point. And that's also tied with another thing. It's not The Power of Love. No, not by Huey Lewis and the News. No, not by Frankie Goes to Hollywood. It's by Chris Chibnall. It's The Power of Three.
Oh, that's the magic number.
And in the 29th place, it's the lovable rogues, the Reverend Captain Hollow Porro's favourite ever Doctor Who story. It's also the reason why it's been carried off to the Funny Farm. It's The Doctor, The Widow and The Wardrobe with 2 points.
Is that his favourite?
Sorry, great mate. Someone's just come in and interrupted the countdown there.
Sorry.
Gonna have to turn off the old Alan Freeman nod off thing going on in the background. What was that?
Is that the ref's favourite?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Of course, yes, it is, isn't it? Yeah. Hang on, it can't be. Did he not vote?
He can't have voted.
Oh, the lazy bastard. I'll give him a kick up the arse. So if he'd bothered to vote, that would have got 7 points. It would have shot up the rankings. Sorry, Hayden, please go ahead.
Who's this Hayden you're talking about, great mate?
Sorry, Smasher. Please continue.
And that's tied on number 29 with the man who's been cancelled, Gareth Roberts' script, The Lodger. And at number 28, no one likes it apart from someone who gave it 3 points, it's Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS.
I thought they'd be lower.
And it's shooting up into the top 25 now, in a kind of shooting up the top 25 kind of way. It's The Rings of Akaten on 4 points, and that's tied with two other stories. That's The Wedding of Riversong, and, what's that? Is that Windows 95 starting up? No, it's Doc Hume's In Flatulence, and you could also call it The Beast Below.
Oh, hey, just hold it there a second. What number is The Beast Below at?
It's tied on number 25.
See, The Beast Below gets a lot of stick. It gets lumped in with, in general, across the whole of Doctor Who, it gets lumped in with stuff like Fear Her. And I just think it's so much better than that. It's not the most amazing. I think it's a bit like, it's that story where they're going to the future after the first introductory episode of The Doctor, isn't it? He's got a new companion, they go into the future. Mm. And I think it's a much better story than it gets credit for. I honestly don't see why it gets the stick that it does. I mean, maybe it's, I think its worst crime is that it's average, possibly. But, it's got Terence Hardman in it, which is obviously fantastic.
Mm. Of course, yep, the demon headmaster himself, yeah.
Well, and
Maya Reinhardt.
The wonderful Maya Reinhardt from Secret Army.
Reinhardt Hans-Dietrich Mayer Luftwaffe.
I think it's a really good premise. I don't...
Well, tell you what, why don't we ask someone who didn't give us any votes at all? Mark!
Well, it's not top five.
It's not something that particularly appeals to me, although I did think one of the best things in it was this idea that every 5 years you go into a voting booth and you have the opportunity to completely forget what's happened over the last 5 years, which you could argue explains a lot about the governments that get elected these days in the UK.
And also it came out around the time of a general election in this country, didn't it?
Yeah, 2010.
So it was topical as well, so I had to have that going for it. Yeah, I don't get the dislike of it, really. I can understand people being perhaps a bit apathetic, perhaps, but...
See, I wouldn't have voted for it, but actually looking down the list, I think it comes a very respectable 7th out of 10 out of those stories in series 5. And I think there's some really good stuff in there. I think you've got some... allows Matt Smith to assert himself more in the role, I think, that story, with being a bit more angry and a bit more alien and a bit more disappointed by humanity in a way that you did see in his previous self, but it lends a bit of a new twist on it. And you've also got the kindness of the Doctor there, and that, you know, you can never ignore a child who's crying. And and actually, Karen Gillan's pretty good in it too, and I like the story premise. I just think, for me, I think there are better stories in that season. I would never lump I would never lump it down there with Fear Her or Love and Monsters or The End of Time.
Love and Monsters? What's that done?
All controversial.
Oh, let's save that for the Tenant one.
Yes, exactly. Or I wouldn't lump it down there with Nightmare in Silver, let's say.
Yeah.
It's got too much going for it to be...
Yeah.
Down there. And plus, it also borrows from an idea from Douglas Adams, of course, as well, which is,
yes, this is true,
always going to work.
Yeah, I wonder if you have a point in that it's in a particularly good season. So quite often, it's a lower point with bigger things around it.
Exactly. All right, shall I continue with the vote?
Bang on, Smashy.
Yeah, number 23, great mates. It's Van Morrison and Eric Clapton. On the Red Dwarf. Oh no, sorry, it's Dinosaurs on a Spaceship.
Lol.
Tied with that on number 23
It's Let's Hug Adolf, i.e. Let's Kill Hitler.
Oh, did I hear Rassilon's horn sounding then?
Yeah, Let's Kill Hitler for me was a bit of an anti-climax, I have to say, when it came out. I remember sitting there aghast, thinking you've had about 3 or 4 months interrupted where you've got no Doctor Who, this is supposed to be the great big comeback, and they started, I felt like, turning a subject like child abduction into a comedy. And I thought it will. I remember exactly the point where I thought this is shit. Was the moment when Rory punches a Nancy. They both get on an old vintage motorcycle and says, "I didn't know you can ride a motorcycle." He's like, "Well, I don't think I can," but it's turned out to be one of those days where it's just like I felt like this was the moment when
it's turned out to be one of those episodes.
Yeah, and it has really, and it I think for me, it's kind of where the wheels come off. With the whole River Song storyline and making light of some pretty serious subject matter, really.
I would say, only in very partial defence of Stephen Moffat here, that with the previous episode, A Good Man Goes to War, he'd written himself into a corner where do we continue to dwell on the child abduction in a realistic manner? Or do we just style it out and crack on with the series? And what's likely to appeal to the audience on a Saturday night? And if this had been on at 9 or 10 p.m., then perhaps they'd have gone for the former. But as it's a huge family audience, they obviously went for the latter. And I'm not sure what he could have done. Like I said, I don't really approve of that storyline. And I would have to say as well, I wonder if Moffat's got some... Moffat seems to think that doing weird, horrible stuff to a baby is a good way to horrify... Well, I mean, it is a good way to horrify the audience. But it's weird because, like, I know we're not talking about Good Man Goes to War, but that scene at the end of it, really, where the baby just kind of pops.
Yes, yeah, collapses yeah. into melts, yeah.
Yeah, it's just absolutely hideous. It's just, I mean, I'm sure Hayden's can possibly relate to this a bit more at the moment as an expectant father. That's just, it's just, yeah. I mean, there's many real life nightmares that are possible with regards to childbirth. You don't need to see, and looking after a small infant, I just think it's a weird thing to do. And then he... Do you remember Dracula that was on over Christmas that Stephen Moffat was involved with as well? The first episode in the story of Dracula, in the book, Dracula carries a baby in a bag and throws it into a room full of vampires. And that's all that's sort of said about it. It's just, you know, he's feeding his other vampires. But it, for some reason, Moffat, with the help of Gattis, decided to make it that the baby's kept in some box where it's turned into a vampire and you get loads of creepy stuff about the creeping vampire, and they're thinking, oh, and you can imagine them laughing going, oh wow, this is really kind of sick, this is going to really, you know, shock people. And it's like, you know, yeah, it's kind of sick, but it's not shocking in a sort of like fun horror way. It's
no,
it's not shocking in the way of turning the empty child into the gas mask wearing zombie.
No.
Is it? It's where it's, you think, oh, that's so scary. It's it's almost, it's just, oh, that's quite nasty, isn't it?
It's like shock rock. It's like the Alice Cooper group doing Dead Babies on one of their albums. It's, you know, it's...
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's emotionally ignorant.
I actually genuinely, that there was a moment in Night Terrors where Amy and Rory get into a lift. And I know that in that story, that was supposed to be, I think, the third episode. And they switched. I think it was that and Curse of the Black Spot around. Because I remember seeing in DWM around the time that the first half of the season they thought was too dark. And that then the second half was a bit too light, having closing time there as well. And they switched it around. So a bit of scheduling going on there, which sort of mucks with the timeline a little bit. But I just thought... Even then, even before I was, you know, before we were pregnant, this never sat well with me, because even if you know that your child is going to grow up and be absolutely fine in the end, you miss out on all that time with them. And that must be heartbreaking.
Mm.
But Amy and Rory, by the end of Let's Kill Hitler, are kind of like, well, all right, well, we know what happens to our baby now, so let's go off to on another adventure. And you just think, was there nobody telling Stephen Moffat at this time that's a bad idea? And I do actually wonder as well, with the advent of the series starting to be split up, and this storyline too, I think this might have been the point where people started to maybe turn on Moffat a bit, and in turn the show as well, with those two things running in tandem.
I'm less sort of shocked by it, possibly because, unlike Mark, I don't have children, and unlike Hayden, there's no real prospect of me having one in the future. But we are pregnant. How did your sympathetic pregnancy go, Hayden? Yes, faithful sisters, I hope you'll forgive any of Hayden's violent mood swings during the last few podcasts. My problem with the baby is more the fact that it being something that will devastate a couple so much, it seems to be almost written off as, oh, well, we'll solve that by a plot twist. You thought you'd missed the opportunity to bring your baby up for 20 years, and it turns out that Mel's was your baby, and so the fact that you've been friends with her for years is really the same as bringing up your own child, isn't it? You know, you've got to raise me after all.
Yeah, it's not like Moffat isn't a father. I mean, I don't know.
I know, that's the weird thing about this.
That's a strange thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And within two stories, you get to Night Terrors, where they are very blasé now about not being able to bring up their own child, are they? Aren't they? They sort of forgotten it.
I think, if anything, again, a very slight thing in Moffat's favour is the fact that there was a season break after A Good Man Goes to War. And so there was those months, which is kind of, it's like, let's hope that kind of, you know, helps people forget a bit about what we did.
Yeah.
But when you think how much in Night Terrors, the relationship between the guy in the flat and his little boy is very much, I am your mummy, I will always be your mummy, or the daddy. He seems to get something right there, but miss it elsewhere. I mean, I can still remember as the credits went up at the end of A Good Man Goes to War, and it says Doctor Who will return in the autumn or something with Let's Kill Hitler. I can still remember my jaw dropping. I think, what on earth is he going to do with that? And didn't really do much, did he?
It's a title promise that they can that they can never live up to as well, isn't it? I mean, they just can't. It's kind of territory that they just shouldn't really bother.
As for Mel's, I'm never really impressed by people who go around firing guns and being rude to people, which is supposed to be the antithesis of Doctor Who, isn't it? But I think we're supposed to regard her as being, oh God, isn't she incredibly cool now, aren't we? But I just find her vile, really. Oh, there we are. So where did that hit us?
That was 23rd. Tied in 23rd.
So that was Let's Kill Hitler. Carry on, Smashy.
In at number 22, It's a Good Man Goes to War with 8 points. And at number 21, only just beating it in a kind of only just beat it with 1 point kind of way, it's A Town Called Mercy on 9 points. And into the top 20 now, we've got Time of the Doctor, Matt Smith's last story, on 11 points.
Well, sorry, what number's Time of the Doctor?
Well, number 20 on 11 points.
Number 20? That really surprises me.
Do I hear the Horn of Rassilon?
Oh, yeah, you certainly do.
Defend it, Mark.
Well, I will admit, I just watched it a few hours ago. And I remember at the time when I watched it, I remember sitting there in my front room in my house over Christmas, on Christmas Day, and towards the end, when Clara's talking to the old doctor, and then there's that whole bit where he struggles up the stairs to the top of that tower, and I was weeping, and then my housemate came in from having dinner at his mum's, and I was sitting there trying to hide my face. You're right, Mark. Yeah, just watching Doctor Who. Everything's fine. And I have to say, this afternoon as well, I still shed a tear. And I think it's a great end to the Matt Smith era. I think it doesn't do a bad job of tying up the incredibly complicated story arcs that have been put in throughout it.
And he has to solve the regeneration cycle problem, doesn't he?
Yes, exactly. And I think there's something wonderfully, heroically romantic about the Doctor thinking, oh, well, I'm not going to regenerate anymore. I'm going to die. So I'm going to protect this town for as long as I can. Mm. And he stays there and he grows old and he looks after them. And it's the complete... what's the word I'm looking for?
It's a nice bow on the 11th Doctor's on his package? Sorry. Scrub that.
Well, he was naked at the start of it, but I didn't see the behind-the-scenes stuff.
Do you know what? I watched this approximately 17 minutes before we started podcasting on this very day. And I think the issue with The Time of the Doctor is that, yes, it ties everything up for his era, but he does it in an hour, where it would have been a hell of a lot better if it was done over a season. And this is something I actually wanted to say about Series 7, not the Inferno, Ambassadors of Death and Silurians era. What was originally supposed to happen was Matt Smith was supposed to stay for a fourth year. But really? He was found... So this was told to me by quite a reliable source back in the day that Matt Smith apparently had stormed off set during the recording of Nightmare in Silver when he was doing the lines of the Cyber Lieutenant or whatever it was. I can't remember now. The Cyber Planner, the Wedding Planner, and the 11th Doctor. Just saying, I don't think I can do this anymore. Now, at that point, you've got to remember, we'd had that split. So you had the 2012 episodes with Amy and Rory, and then you had at Christmas, Clara comes in with the snowmen, and then obviously Bells of St. John and onwards.
Yeah.
From that part onwards, this is a totally different era, almost. There's a new title sequence, there's a new TARDIS, there's a new costume for the Doctor, there's a new companion.
Yeah.
You've got more stories with the Paternoster gang, kind of having them sort of in the same way as you have with UNIT, with previous eras of the show. It was so clear that half a season with this setup wasn't the original plan at all. And I think, personally, I think Moffat was planning to tie all these ideas up in a fourth year with Matt Smith. Because he even came out in the press and said, yes, I am doing a fourth year. And I think it literally, I think he just kind of said, no, I can't do this anymore. Because remember, for the 50th, he wasn't even contracted to do that initially. It was only, I think at one point, Stephen Moffat said, yeah, I actually only had Clara. I only had Jenna Coleman committed to the 50th.
Yeah, I do remember him saying that.
Yeah, so if he had have signed up for a fourth year, he would have been contracted at that point. And also, they filmed Time of the Doctor. It was an incredible turnaround. It was something like August or September of 2013, because he'd already left and he'd had shaved his head. He'd been in a film, hadn't he? A Ryan Gosling film, which was why they had to necessitate the wig. And I just think that's the problem with Time of the Doctor, is that it so clearly was not supposed to be Matt Smith's final story. It was perhaps supposed to be the setup for a season-long arc where all of these things were going to be tied up, and then at the very end of it, you'd have the Christmas Trenzalore, you know, protecting it. And
do you think it was just at the last minute then?
Yes, almost certainly.
Well, do you know what? In which case, I'm even more impressed.
Yeah.
Because I think to actually do it, I mean, for me, I found the whole thing, I know not everyone did, because I remember people talking about it at the time. Mm. But I found it a very satisfying end, emotionally satisfying. And like I said, it does do a whiz round of just tying up those few knots. I love the character Tasha Lem. I know that's probably something that's going to come back later on, I think, in regards to Stephen Moffat female characters. But you laugh at me, but it felt magical to me.
Yeah.
And I have such strong memories of it on the broadcast. I mean, initially, it wasn't going to be in my top five when you first drew Matt Smith out of the hat.
Mm.
And it was just that rewatch this afternoon made me reconsider my top five. And I think I put it in at second, didn't I? Which,
yeah, that's right.
I mean, to be honest, everything apart from number one in my top five is probably interchangeable on a daily basis.
Do you know what the biggest giveaway is, that this wasn't supposed to be initially Matt Smith's last story? is the fact that they build up in Day of the Doctor all about that I've got to go find Gallifrey the long way round. Then less than a month, or just over a month later, in the next episode, oh, I found Gallifrey, it's in that crack.
Well, he still went the long way round, you could argue, considering how long he was on
Christmas
stroke Trenzor.
Yeah, I suppose so, but yeah, it so clearly was everything chucked into one, and I'm with you, Mark. I mean, it's a really good Christmas story. Like I said, I watched it again just before we started recording, and it was a lot stronger than I remembered. And even this time, I had a tear in my eye towards the end of it too. I think it's where Stephen Moffat's writing really comes to the fore, is when he is under pressure. And he can deliver something like that, which I will get onto with another story, but anyway.
What I find slightly bizarre about it is that it's like the silly thing with the abstract noun beginning with an R for Dalek stories. Having the last three episodes being the name of the Doctor, the day of the Doctor, the time of the Doctor, I struggle to remember which is which, particularly when you would think that final story would be called the name of the Doctor, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Because that's the one... The one where Clara jumps into his time stream. Well, that's... You thought that would be the perfect point, the time of the Doctor. The one that ends with them having to reveal or withhold his name should be the name of the Doctor. I have nothing particularly against it. It just didn't really do much for me, for reasons which I'll get into as we when we come to talking about an overview of the era more generally.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, Smashy, do you want to give us the countdown from 20 to 11?
Okay, Pop Pickers, coming in now on a tied in the 18th place in the rundown between 20th and 11th. We have, on 13 points, The Vampires of Venice and The Bells of St. John.
Not the Horn of Rassilon again, surely.
No, I think that was just your vaccination chip going again, Doc.
Hayden, would you like to say something about Season 7, didn't you, in general?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's a weird beast, Season 7. Sorry, again. Bloody hell.
Oh, you're not a true Doctor Who fan. You keep getting the seasons wrong.
Series 7.
7A and 7B.
Yeah, is that they are very distinct. Like I said, they're almost like two different distinct eras. It's like there's a hard reset after the Pons leave, where, like I said, everything kind of changes and it feels like they're trying to freshen up the show again.
Which is understandable in a way, isn't it, if you're getting a new companion.
Yeah, but you get a new everything. That's what I mean. It's like it's a new costume, new title sequence, new TARDIS, new companion. It feels like you're in a totally different season, almost, or a series at this point. Bells of St. John, on my rewatch, I found this was a bit of a hidden gem, actually. I think it's really good. It's a good introduction for Clara, for the Clara who obviously stays with the Doctor, not the one who dies
twice.
The one who dies twice. I quite like their chemistry right from the off, and I really like how it's the Great Intelligence is the big bad in this. Again, feels like it, you know, this is feels like episode one of a new series through a thread that's going to run through. It's the idea about people getting trapped in the Wi-Fi. It goes back to Stephen Moffat doing what he does best, and that's taking an everyday thing or an everyday object and making it scary, like he did with gargoyles and statues with the Weeping Angels, like he did with gas mask kids and the innocent question, are you my mummy? And also with shadows, of course, as well, in Silence in the Library. This is, you know, sinister Wi-Fi. And considering what techno fear some people may have, I thought this is something that really played on it, where it's almost sort of trapping the souls about. Just a really good concept, where it turns out that when the Great Intelligence takes over the minds of people, he's taking over, when they go back, no longer being under his control, they go back and they first encountered the Great Intelligence. And she's sort of sitting on the floor saying, oh, where's my mummy? That moment, I thought that was chilling on first watch. And I watched it again and I thought, oh, blimey. I do remember at the time thinking the bike going up the shard was a bit silly, but actually I quite enjoyed it this time. And I don't know. It's just a good start, really, to that second series. And like I said, it is even as good as I thought Capaldi was and as good as some of those stories in Series 8 was. I would have loved to have seen Clara and the 11th Doctor in another, give it another year.
Yeah, I think so too, because that's one of the other things I really enjoyed about, sorry, going back to the time of the Doctor, and it's there in Bells of St. John as well, is the dialogue between the two of them is, as it often is actually between, I mean, he does it quite well with the 12th in a different way, and Clara as well, but he writes good comedy, and he writes good dialogue.
Yeah.
And when you've got that going on, I can watch these people talking and sniping at each other in a kind of affectionate way, and not like in a Sixth Doctor Perry kind of way, but
yeah,
I can watch that, and you can tell that Stephen Moffat's a guy who's been writing sitcoms for most of his life, because the dialogue just drops in naturally and it's funny, and I think they did have good chemistry together.
Personally, I can't make up my mind whether I find the greatest advantage of Clara is that it makes me think better of Amy, or whether it's the greatest advantage of Amy is it makes me feel better of Clara, if only by comparison.
Well, I'll come on to my opinion on that in a bit.
I think it's significant that I just had no realisation. That was quite a surprise to me when Hayden said that. That the Bells of St. John story is linked to the Great Intelligence. Because when I was rewatching that in the last few weeks for this podcast, I sort of nodded off for about 5 minutes towards the end and couldn't really be bothered rewinding. And when you consider that, that must almost mean that I must have done something similar on first broadcast as well, not to remember. I think it's interesting that I'd never heard that story about Matt, you know, suddenly deciding to give up during in the middle of Nightmare in Silver. I mean, to me, I don't know about him doing it while he's acting being the cyber planner. I'd have thought being presented with those two smug kids would be the point at which you'd say, I can't go any further. I'll comment about Clara more generally towards the end of the story. What I do think about Name of the Doctor is that she hasn't been there long enough. She's been there, what? They had that little bit with her as Oswin in Asylum. And then she's been there, for about maybe just over half a season, really. And I don't think it's long enough, for me anyway, for me to feel that she's... Firstly, if you think about this leaping into the Doctor's timeline and then being allowed to influence one of the key moments of the show's history, the first Doctor stealing the TARDIS, firstly, she hasn't been there long enough for me to believe that she'd become so enamoured of the Doctor that she'd want to do it. Or, for having her done it, for me to feel, oh, she's earned it.
Can I just say, though, this is another problem where what was planned didn't happen, and so they've had to make do, as Hayden alluded to earlier, because Clara's character was always supposed to be Elizabeth Sladen, playing Sarah Jane Smith, because she was the most beloved of all the old companions.
Of course, yes.
So it was supposed to be Sarah Jane Smith. Now, if you think about that, even some of the dialogue, I think there's a bit where in the Name of the Doctor, the 11th Doctor is carrying her, and he's saying, oh, Clara, my Clara, that. And she even says at one point, my Doctor, doesn't she, I think, in that.
Mm.
And that's something I think that Sarah Jane says in School Reunion.
Doesn't the 10th Doctor say to her at the end of School Reunion, my Sarah Jane?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, that's interesting, because when I was saying I don't think she's earned it, I was about to end that with saying, you know, it's not like she's someone like Sarah.
Ah.
You know, because that's exactly the sort of thing. So that is interesting, that. Was that forestalled by Liz's death?
Yeah, it was, sadly.
I really should read DWM more.
See, this is why I can forgive this a little more. And then when you know that context, I think it's the reverse. Like Mark said on our Fifth Doctor retrospective, you know, knowing a bit more about the behind the scenes on Mordred and Undead affected the story a bit for him, because it wasn't Ian Chesterton as planned. But actually, in this sense, it I can kind of forgive it a bit more, because it was another instance, like Mark said, of having to make do. Actually, do you know what I mean? If she had stuck around, I mean, it was too long anyway, I think, even to be in the first half of Series 7. But even if it was Amy, who was the one who jumped into his time stream, it would have made more sense. But of course, that's not what happened, and she wasn't there at that point. And, you know, I don't mind that Clara did that. I mean, to be honest, Joe Grant, after five stories, stands in front of the Doctor when Azal threatens to kill him. So, I mean, it's, I know this is a bit more of a grand point, I guess, and a more of a grand gesture, but at the same time, it's, I don't know, along the same lines, I guess. You know, there are points in the Matt Smith era where things haven't quite worked out, and you can forgive it for knowing a bit of what was going on behind the scenes, I think. I think they did very well with that.
Okay, in a number 17 on 14 points, we've got The Girl Who Waited.
Oh, hark! Is that Russell Lott's horn I hear?
It is. This isn't anything I gave any votes to, but it is something that I gave quite a lot of vicious thoughts to in my notes.
Oh.
It's mainly about the character of Amy, really, so perhaps I ought to leave it until we discuss Amy more as an overview. But I found it one of the most really awful stories of Matt Smith's era, this The Girl Who Waited.
There's the sigh I know and love.
It's the essential selfishness of Amy. Because it looks to me as if the character of Amy, without her looks, is left with essentially nothing apart from being essentially selfish. So much of the stuff she talks about here is, she'll say, woman with a sword, don't push it.
You saved me.
Don't get used to it.
You've been crying. A little bit.
Shut up, Rory.
You have, haven't you?
Woman with a sword, don't push it.
Who says that about themselves without needing first a ton of self-regard?
Well, she's pretty much the only human that she's known for decades.
Yeah.
You would perhaps become a little bit self-absorbed.
If we were to think it's impressive, then make her impressive. It doesn't seem to matter that she's unbearable. Well, as far as I'm concerned, she is. The fact that she's bolshy is supposed to make up for that. In fact, I was even reading... who was it that said this? Oh, I think I was reading something that was written by Dr. Sandifer, no less, who described Amy in The Girl Who Waited as intentionally feminist writing on Stephen Moffat's part. And you think there's only one character who's ever chauvinistic towards Amy. That's actually the Doctor. And he hardly ever gets any comeback from her. Someone like Rory, who's actually hopelessly worships her, gets treated like dirt. How is that intentionally feminist writing? I seem to remember people saying, almost as early as The 11th Hour, oh, I'm sure that this character of Amy is being written as selfish and annoying because it's looking forward to that being a plot point, you know, in the sense that Rose and the 10th Doctor being arrogant and self-satisfied is supposed to become a plot point later on in the series, and it will lead to her downfall. It didn't. And even if it had, it wouldn't have been justified. I mean, she's complaining that her existence and the past 36 years have been hell. Then she resents becoming what she would otherwise have become when she gets the chance of having those years wiped away. I've had a hellish 36 years and you're not taking that away from me. Oh, go f*** off, Amy. She's got a grudge, and by God, is she going to nurse it. Whereas, we'll see later on, that Kazran in Christmas Carol is the opposite. He sees what he's become, and he wants it to change. I just find it's almost the epitome, this, of the unlikability of Amy. In my opinion, I'm sure there'll be lots of people who like her.
Yeah, I like her.
Yes, it's certainly a sad moment at the end when the older Amy sees Rory carrying younger Amy unconscious into the TARDIS, and the Doctor closes the doors on older Amy. Yes, it's sad, but does anyone really want crabby old Amy to stay?
Do you think, though, it's a good idea, perhaps, to have a companion like this, because they are different to all the other companions, no, but where they are less selfish and they are, you know, would think about the Doctor or would think about humanity more. I know Amy does have patches of that, like in The Beast Below, you know, she talks about the children crying and presses the button on the vote, doesn't she, to stop the torture of the whale. She has those moments. I think the issue is with her is that when she has Rory around, it kind of exacerbates that problem. And for me, I mean, those three, 11, Amy and Rory, I love that setup. But looking back now on this rewatch, and this is the first time I've rewatched Matt Smith's stuff since it went out, because it still feels so new and fresh to me. Watching it this time, I feel really sorry for Rory.
Oh, yeah.
I did then as well. But I think it's interesting that you do have a companion there who is a bit more me, me, me. I mean, this is someone who effectively cheats on her fiancé the night before her wedding, or plans to cheat on, you know, she's a broken individual. And it's the Doctor's fault, in some parts of that, because she never grew up with a mum and a dad there, and he broke a promise.
I think she tends to live in the moment a lot more.
Yeah.
And I think that perhaps that could be to do with the fact that as a child she had that crack in the wall.
Yeah.
Pouring all that time stuff into her head and all the people and things around her disappearing. That's how I would excuse Annie, yeah. I think.
I can certainly understand her being like that. What I was saying is, I don't really like characters like that being in Doctor Who. Why make someone just unpleasant for the sake of doing something different?
Mm. Yeah, see, I don't know. I don't find all that unpleasant necessarily. Not all the... she does some stuff. I think the incident with Doctor at the end of Time of Ages, Flesh and Stone, I think because that's happened immediately after she's been in the most mortal danger she's ever been in, I don't think it's appropriate for a children's show.
No.
Not a children's show, a family show to show it, but I do think it's probably realistically...
The very nerve to call it that, Mark.
I do think it's quite realistic psychologically that immediately after coming out of something like that, that I think people do throw themselves together. Survivors who've been through a near-death experience like that.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, you're right with that. I think the issue here is that there wasn't enough times when Rory batted back. There isn't enough points, like when he's in the Big Bang, when she's saying, oh, I don't hear anything. He goes, trust the Sonic. And she kind of like raises her eyebrows to that, as in, oh, Willow, you know, he fought back a bit there. And there wasn't enough points like that. They made Rory a bit too wet, I think, really, in the end, which was a shame, because like I said, I actually do like that lineup. But there's moments in Series 6 where it gets a bit difficult.
No, exactly, yeah. For Rory, Amy is everything. Amy occasionally has to be reminded that Rory even exists. So how is this feminism? It's all predicated anyway on a daft idea that they turn up at this planet, they go off towards a door with a green and red button. I mean, first of all, who presses the green and red button presses the red one? Even if it was no more than, you know, up and down in a lift, why would the Doctor and Rory wander off and leave Amy to work out which one they'd pressed? I think that's a bit silly. I don't think she's well written in this. And I think... You see, I don't particularly like Clara either. Whereas I've no problem with the companions in the RTD era. I mean, personally, I've often wondered whether... No, I don't know, I'm just going to say this, because it's... if you look at something like Coupling, that Stephen Moffat, which I love, it's all men as fools.
Yeah.
And patient women putting up with them. Now, yeah. I mean, that's fine as a meme, but when you see it's a lot of... It's happening here as well. I mean, this thing about, you know, it's, admittedly, I think it's mainly with, it happens once with Matt Smith, it's mainly with Peter Capaldi's Doctor. How often Clara keeps slapping him across the face and gets away with it. And he's writing women like this. You do wonder. I think I said this once before, I think, that it's almost as if he's using his writing as a way to apologise to the female sex for something. Well, fast forward, I mean, I don't apologise for anything I've done, because I've not done anything. I just wonder whether he feels guilty about something and feels he needs to write sort of male-female relationships like this.
I think it's stereotypical in media to make the men the fools and make the women... And I'm not, you know, I've got nothing against making the women look stronger, but I feel like there has to be a balance sometimes. Funnily enough, I was talking about this recently to my wife because, well, obviously we've had antenatal classes over Zoom recently, and the point was brought up then where, you know, actually just how important the birthing partner's role is.
Yeah.
In that point. But actually, when you watch TV shows or you watch films and someone goes into labour, the guy is an absolute idiot in that. You know, think of Hugh Grant in, oh God, what's it called? Is it called 9 and a Half Months? I can't remember now. But anyway, there's a film with Hugh Grant and...
2 weeks' notice, isn't it?
Something like that, yeah. And he's there, and he's an idiot. Knocked Up, Seth Rogen, the guy's a complete idiot. And Del Boy in Only Fools and Horses, you know, playing it, obviously for a comedy, playing up for laughs. And he's just thinking, and I've been watching this stuff recently, and obviously having the feeling as well of, you know, there's an awful lot of fathers in the last year. Sorry, we're getting off a little bit off topic. But anyway, in the last year, there's an awful lot of fathers who have missed the birth of their child and also not been allowed to attend appointments where they've discovered something's wrong with the baby, or unfortunately the woman's lost the baby. How horrible that is. But the fathers are second rate. They wait outside the hospital like dogs tied to a leash, tied to an advertisement board outside the newsagents. It's awful.
You see, I don't see it as writing strong women. Do you remember when my reaction to the unveiling of Jodie as the 13th Doctor? My reaction was, I worried with the sort of writers they had, and I suspect maybe I was thinking of writers who maybe look at Stephen Moffat as an example to go along by, is that they'll say, oh, so we've got a main character who's a woman. How should we make sure it's being strong? Mm. Well, because it's nearly always men writing it, they'll think, oh, we don't really know. I know, let's write the men around her as weak morons. And I think that's the way that, the only way at all, if she does, that Amy appears strong during this period, it's that she's put up against a weak character in Rory. She's just actually strong in it, or admirably strong in any other way.
Yeah. The thing is, a lot of this is quite often done for comedy, and a lot of the examples Hayden gave are for comedy. And obviously, there's a general feeling, which I tend to agree with, that comedy should be punching up as opposed to punching down, so to speak. And the fact is that we are still behind in many areas in society.
Yeah.
With regards to female equality. So maybe that explains Stephen Moffat's writing on it. So he's trying to be more feminist, but it's at the detriment of the male characters.
I think that's what's being aimed for. I just think it fails disastrously because it doesn't make her in any way admirable. She's played strong by giving her all the characteristics of strength as defined by masculine cliches. Aggressiveness, threatening, demanding attention. Probably, I think, because she's written by men who, I'm not saying because you don't understand women, but I don't get much of an idea that many of the Doctor Who writers do. Just annoys me beyond belief the way that it's written like this. Here's another line I read from someone wrote about Amy. She runs the whole gamut of female empowerment from kissogram to perfume model. So all I'm doing is a time when fandom is so woke and so full of those social justice warriors. God, people have been insisting on social justice for people. It's defending the male corner here. But will anyone nominate us for a podcasting award for our innovative use of a single-sex podcast? Well, they're buggery. But let's get away from that. Smashy, crack on.
Right, at number 15 is joint on 16 points is The Name of the Doctor and the Snowmen. At number 14 on 23 points, it's Hyde. And completing a myriad of Series 7 episodes here on 24 points at number 13 is Cold War. At number 12, Amy's Choice brings up the collection of Series 7 episodes on 27 points, whilst we go back again just before we get into the top 10 type thing. On 28 points, number 11 is The Crimson Horror.
And that brings us to the second of our episodes that we voted. I put Crimson Horror in at 5th. I must have confessed there were probably 4 or 5 stories I could have put in here. And on another day, I might have voted another one. But I think Crimson Horror stands out as the jewel among otherwise pretty second-rate Series 7.
Ooh, interesting. You say that, but we've got 7 Series 7 episodes that are in the top 20.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Interesting.
Not least because Dinah Riggs shows it's possible to do a broad northern accent without filling it full of glottal stops. Broad northern accent, but crisp, perfect enunciation.
I really like this one, actually. This was one of those... I had a bottleneck where I had a top three, and then after that I had about 6 episodes which were all vying for that fourth and fifth spot. And I have to say, Prison Horror was one of them. Because I quite like the formatting of it. The fact that the Doctor wasn't in it the whole time, and
wasn't until the
second half. And when he does turn up, it's a bit of a surprise as to how him and Clara get into the situation. It's told through backstory, and you're given that first 20 or 25 minutes or so with the Paternoster gang kind of having their own. Because, I think the intention was this was supposed to be the starting point of a spin-off series. But obviously at this point, Sherlock was a juggernaut, and Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss couldn't jump off, and which was a shame.
Paternoster gang.
That's it, and this was a different kind of telling. I liked how it wasn't Madame Vastra at the front of it, it was Jenny as well. It was just a different feel to it. I really like Crimson Horror. What about you, Mark?
Well, I will just say I do love the Paternoster gang. I know they're not everybody's cup of tea, but I absolutely adore them. And just any episodes with them in do get a slight bump up, in my opinion. I have no problems with Strax being the comedy Sontaran. I think there's room in all of Doctor Who for that. I mean, Sontarans have always been kind of funny, really, ever since Robert Holmes first created them.
That's true.
Smashy, take us away in the top 10, please.
In at number 10, on 33 points, we've got The Impossible Astronaut and Day of the Moon. And at number 9, on 39 points, we've got Asylum of the Daleks. Not off.
Can I just say, Impossible Astronaut, Day of the Moon is one that I will always have fond memories of, because it's one of these stories that I've watched most often with my daughter Polly. I just think it's a cracking start to Series 6. Yeah, I just think it's a really strong, confident start to the new series, and it's a new Who story that I've probably watched the most.
And in fact, Polly gives it all 5 points in her first place.
Yeah. Indeed she does, yes.
Wow.
Okay, at number 9, on 39 points, is Asylum of the Daleks. And at number 8, at number 45, it's our highest entry for a Christmas special, and that is A Christmas Carol.
Hooray!
And in at number 7, on 50 points, is The God Complex. And at number 6, on 61 points, is The Time of Angels and Flesh and Stone. Bit of a surprise there. I thought they'd be further up, but anyway.
They should have been higher. Was that higher? Yes, higher.
Oh, do I hear Russell's horn blowing?
Do I hear Bruce's buzzing?
Bruce's bee buzzing.
Yeah. Time for Flesh and Stone, I'm really surprised it's not in the top 5. It's my top story. It's one of my favourite Doctor Who stories, certainly from the new series of all time, and it probably stands up pretty well against the classic series as well to me. Excluding the epilogue, which we've already discussed, which I tend to stop the disc before watching, I just think it's almost perfect. I'm not sure I know of another Doctor Who story where I'm so tense all the way through. Once the story gets in past the first few introductory minutes, just constant tension for 2 episodes. And I find the horror elements in it, I find it really disturbing, the way that Amy starts counting down.
Oh, yes, yes. And you don't notice at first, do you?
No. I mean, obviously you do on later rewatches. And it's just, Angel Bob, I think, is a great villain in its own way. They keep asking, why are you counting down for fun? And when they're walking through those statues, and again, it's something something I certainly didn't notice the first time I was watching it.
No, exactly.
But I'm very aware of the second time when they're talking about the two-headed people, and they're going, something's wrong here. And then the Doctor says, I've made a mistake and we're all in terrible danger. It reminds me of that moment in the Horror of Fang Rock, where the fourth Doctor says, I haven't locked it out, I've locked it in with us. And it's just, you know, Amy turned to stone. The way Matt Smith, when he's talking to Angel Bob, he's sort of blinking tears back when they're saying about how he died in fear.
Yeah.
You know, and there's that bit, why are you telling me, why are you doing this? He says, to make you angry.
Yeah.
And it's just, oh, I just think it's wonderful. And it just doesn't really stop. I love the forest as an oxygen factory on board the ship.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
The music is superb. Maybe we'll go back to that when we talk about an overall thing for the Matt Smith era. When Amy's by herself sat and she's got all those soldiers around here, and two of them go off, and the other guy can't remember them ever existing. And it's just, that's really spooky. Yeah, I just feel all the way through. The only bit I would say is the bit where Amy's forced to walk through the forest with her eyes shut seems like quite a stretch. And the angels, I know they explained that they're too busy worrying about the crack to take a lot of notice of Amy, but it seems a bit of a stretch that they think she might be looking at them. But I think, like I say, apart from the epilogue, almost a perfect Doctor Who story for me.
Can I just add to that another very clever idea that I've always thought was brilliant by Moffat, and that was the idea of the clergy becoming soldiers.
Oh,
because when you
yes.
think of all the wars that have taken place over the centuries and millennia, and it's almost all of the time have been in the name of religion. And
yeah,
I just
the
thought,
Knights Templar as well and yeah, stuff like that.
Exactly, yeah. And I just thought that was so clever. I really like that idea.
I think it's such a pity that this... I mean, I love the character of Father Octavian, who's clearly playing a substitute brigadier's role. And he gets quite needled by the Doctor. And then he gets to go back to him with, you know, where the Doctor says, your soldiers keep dying. He says, yes, I know that.
Yeah. Called you an idiot. Sorry, but there's no way we could have rescued you.
I know that, sir. And when you've flown away in your little blue box, I'll explain that to their families.
Yeah.
And his death. I'd like to have known you better.
Yes.
And I think it's a pity that this church militant, quite soon in when you reach Goodman Goes to War, they're turned into a gang of fascist nutters, really, aren't they?
Well, I'm not sure whereabouts in the timeline that comes, though. Is that before or after? But
I'm not sure. I think it's been quite interesting to come across them every now and then. Yeah, if they're run by people like Ian Glenn rather than Hyder.
Yeah.
I will die in the knowledge that my courage did not deserve me at the end. For that I thank God and bless the path that takes you to safety.
We should learn you better.
I think so. You know me at my best.
Ready?
Content.
And you know what you were saying earlier, Mark, about if comedy has to punch, you prefer it to punch up rather than punching down. I think this is an example of punching up. The Doctor being snarky towards Father Octavian to show that he's not keen on the military, suddenly, or the church. And then Father Octavian is snarky back at the Doctor with his, when you've flown away in your little box, and at River, you know, saying, look, if you step out of line, I'm going to tell the Doctor what's the truth about you. Whereas I don't really see that much how much Amy being unkind to Rory is punching up.
No.
Sort of punching downwards. My boyfriend is a slightly insecure NHS nurse. my God, he's part of the patriarchy, isn't he? I mean, this story would be up there for me, even if it was rubbish, if only for the best ever opening in
A
Doctor Who's. It's like the opening of The Spy Who Loved Me.
Yes.
Where Bond
skis
off the end of the cliff, and then his Union Jack parachute opens. I mean, things like those iconic shots of River's red heels and her welding shades. I think, just... glorious, then she collides into the TARDIS and just says, follow that ship, and you go straight into the Oh, by the way, what I think are still, with possible exception of the Tom Baker Diamond logo, possibly the best opening titles ever.
Yeah.
I think. Absolutely lovely.
Yeah. Can I just say as well, and I just think Matt Smith throughout the whole of this, I think his acting's brilliant. I do think he goes to a lot of different places.
Well, this is his first ever story, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, it was. Yeah. First one he recorded.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So Time of Angels, Flesh and Stone, Mark gave that a full 5 points in first place. I gave it 3 points in third place. It might have been a bit higher. It only needed three more points to move one place up. But unfortunately, Hayden didn't give it any points, Mark.
No, I didn't. I didn't.
Oh.
Looking at this list, number seven, The God Complex, I think is a fantastic story. But the only reason why I didn't give it any votes is because they missed out on the chance to kill off David Walliams and something.
I was going to joke. Oh, was it because David Walliams was in it? You hadn't realised you were actually going to say it.
I thought you were going to say because it had because it mentioned the word Nymon.
And that, yeah, they are the two cardinal sins. It also should have been the point where they left, where Amy and Rory left for good as well, I thought. But anyway, there we go. Do you know what? There was a part of me that felt like, again, this was one of those that was knocking on the door and that was bottlenecking into the top five. Like, the top ten. Actually, do you know, apart from Asylum, I take Asylum out, put Crimson Horror in, and potentially take out... no, that probably would be my top ten. But it's just so difficult, I think, to really juggle them around. Yeah. I know. And looking at it now, Time of Angels, yeah, it's sacrilege that I didn't put it in the top five. But do you know what? I didn't want to be... I'll get to it later on, the reason why I haven't put it in.
Yeah, I'd also concur that I think after you've put in maybe one to three, your top one to three, that there's quite a large number of stories jockeying for the next, 17 positions almost, which is quite a credit to it.
Yeah, the only other time when we've done the retrospectives and I've had struggled this much with a top five was Tom Baker's one. Really. And I think it is because of the quality of the stories.
Yes.
Which really helps. It's a bit more black and white with things like McCoy and Eccleston and Peter Davison, where actually this time round I really did struggle.
Well, I know at least one of our listeners who I knew had a problem making a top five because they knew one that they liked and they didn't like any of any God. Other episodes. But,
oh, I think I know who that is.
Yeah.
We one know of who our... you are. Yes.
I think a case in point of that is Christmas Carol, which I think is a stunning episode, but it's only both Kay Hayden and I put it in fourth place for ourselves.
Mm.
I remember watching this on Christmas Day, 2015, would it have been? No,
2010.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And, God, 10 years ago.
I know.
And thinking, oh, didn't like that at all. I don't know whether I was just too stuffed full of Christmas dinner or whatever. Watched it again on New Year's Day. On a repeat, and absolutely loved it. Don't know what it was that changed my mind. Maybe I wasn't concentrating so much. Maybe I fell asleep and didn't notice the first time. Tour de force by Michael Gambon.
Yeah.
Great actor, but acting in it completely the right way for Doctor Who. And of course, I'll get this in. A great example of how you can bother to sound consonants in your words, and by doing so, produce a much wider range of emotion.
Yeah.
And effect. I'm far more interested in how characters are feeling than where they came from or what class they're pretending to be from. Yeah, the floating sharks and the singing is fundamentally silly, but it works because it's beautiful as part of the characterization. In fact, spoiled a little for me by flashes back to the people on the ship doing shouting acting, which I shall come back to. But Christmas Carols stands up for me as being one of those stories that, I know I say this again and again, but Doctor Who stories that make me cry, I find extraordinary. The bits at the end where they're in the basement with all the, you know, the coffins, and Kazran's doing his all my life I've been called heartless speech, and the Doctor says, better to have a broken heart than no heart at all, and Kazran comes right back to him with, you try it.
Yeah.
And that, oh, every time he says that, I'm just astonished at the quality of what of the actor.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just, and then Matt does that thing where he's talking to Kazran, and we know that little Kazran is behind him. He doesn't know that, but Matt doesn't, you know, just move his head and look to someone else. It's just by the change of the tone in his voice, he says, "I am showing the future. I am showing you the future." So, what do you think, Kazran? And the older Kazran realizes he's talking to someone else. He turns around.
I didn't realize.
All my life I've been called heartless. My other life, my real life, the one you rewrote. Now look at me.
Better a broken heart than no heart at all.
You try it. You try it. Why are you here?
Because I'm not finished with you yet. You've seen the past, present, and now you need to see the future.
Fine, do it, show me. I'll die cold, alone, and afraid. Of course I will, we all do. What difference does showing me make? Do you know why I'm going to let those people die? Not a plan. I don't get anything from it. It's just that I don't care. I'm not like you. I don't even want to be like you. I don't and never ever will care.
And I don't believe that.
And show me the future. Prove me wrong.
I am showing it to you. I'm showing it to you right now. So what do you think? Is this who you want to become, Kazran?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, glorious. Glorious to me, glorious. So lots of things must have been... What did I put above this to justify it only being in fourth place? Hang on. Yeah, I suppose. I could possibly, depending on which day I voted on this, I could possibly have interchanged this, you know, swapped it either way with the Angels two-parter.
Right.
I think the quality of the Matt Smith Doctor Who Christmas specials is pretty good. 3 out of 4 hits, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree with you there. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, actually, funny enough, I was watching this around Christmas, and I actually messaged Doc, and I said to you, I don't know if you remember this, Doc, but I said to you, why can't Doctor Who be more like this now?
Well, this can't have been 2010.
It was.
Because we weren't podcasting until 2014.
No, I mean...
Oh, you a Christmas,
this
you
Christmas.
Mean?
I watched this Christmas mean, and I messaged you.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Shall we see what's in the top five, dear listeners?
Yes, let's.
Smashy, let's take us into the top five, shall we?
Right, top five now, and on 64 points, it's the Pandorica opens and the Big Bang. And in at number four, a non-mover at 84, quite a jump there, listeners, is The Doctor's Wife. Another massive jump into the top three now, on 112 points, is Vincent and the Doctor. And the plucky runner-up here this time round, dear listeners, on 151 points, Tickle Me Pink. I am astonished, but that's fantastic for such a brilliant episode in the 11th hour. Which means that our number one, and our number one this time round, dear listeners, at 206 points, is wow. The Day of the Doctor.
Oh, that's just stealing points from the 11th hour. Whose idea was it to have the Day of the Doctor's a Matt Smith episode?
Calling UEFA. We've got a...
There's got to be a transfer ban on Day of the Doctor. How dare they get...
Yeah, they signed John Hurt. That wasn't fair.
How come they get David Tennant to play up front as Sergio Aguero? I can't
they got David Tennant and John Hurt playing up front with Matt Smith.
Right, okay. So with the top five being what it is... That is an incredibly...
Yeah.
That's what? Incredibly strong top five. But I am not shocked to see this, but I'm just counting up now. You've got three Series 5 episodes in there.
Yeah.
You've got the 50th anniversary special, and you've got one episode from Series 6. Series 5... I always thought was the strongest on transmission, and it's interesting to see that that's been reflected here.
It feels like Matt Smith's done a reverse McCoy, doesn't it?
Yeah, yes. It does a bit, actually.
Yeah.
Although, like I pointed out earlier, the vast majority of Series 7 is in the top 20.
Well, yes. Mm.
Does anyone want to talk about the Doctor's wife?
Well, it's only you that have actually given us any points, Aidan. You gave us it third.
Oh, okay. I don't want to dominate, though. That's...
I like it, but it's not something... It's not in my top five.
Okay.
The Doctor's wife was actually in my top five until I became an absolute emotional wreck watching
Simon the Doctor.
So, yeah, it's... I think Doctor's wife's brilliant story. There's so many that could have made it into my top five. There really is.
The only other thing I'd say about... Pandorica Opens. Again, this is one that was bottlenecking. The only reason why it didn't get into my top five in the end was because of the pace change, well, between the two episodes. I loved the setup at the beginning where you go back to young Amelia again. But the story kind of does completely stop after that brilliant, you know, the bit with Amy's in the Pandorica. Okay, kiddo, this is where it gets complicated. It feels to me after that, when the gang's kind of all together, it just feels as though the Doctor's doing a lot of talking and a lot of explaining, and there's not much else going on, and occasionally gets broken up by the Dalek turning up. Then they're in a different room, and then it goes back to the Doctor explaining again until the Dalek turns up again. And that was its only downfall for me. But I think the speech at the end of the episode, near the end of the episode, where you got the Doctor talking to young Amelia in when he puts her to bed and starts talking about, you'll remember that silly old man in the box, is one of the reasons why I think Matt Smith is one of the best Doctors. This is a 27-year-old man talking through the voice of a centuries-year-old alien and making it completely believable.
Yeah. I was a wreck. And what you're saying about the change of pace is, when you consider that the Pandorica ends with the same way that Time of Angels is probably the best opener of all time. This could be one of the best finale teasers of all time. There's Go to Your Room. But it's built up to, you've got this story which is, I thought it was interesting. I saw someone in Radio Times, one of the reviewers of Doctor Who, describe it as one of those hook upon hook stories whereby, you know, something grabs you and then you've not got time to lose interest because something else interesting grabs you and grabs you and grabs you. Where you're carried along at such a pace, you've got these, oh, it's River, oh, it's Stonehenge, oh, it's under Stonehenge, oh, it's the Pandorica, oh, it's just a Cyberman head attacking, oh, it's Rory as an autumn. You know, that you can't, in my opinion, one can't avoid enjoying it. And it leads up to that tremendous emotional powerhouse. You've got the Doctor being dragged away to the Pandorica, Rory killing Amy, then cradling her arms, and River trapped in an exploding TARDIS. And you think, oh, God, no! A whole week to wait.
And as you pull out from the Earth, watching all the other stars blink out. And it finishes in silence, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And a great point for Amy. I'm not saying that Amy doesn't have a good point. Well, she's getting emotional here when she realises they're out up top while the Doctor's still down bottom in Stonehenge. And she starts realising who he is. And there are other parts of this scattered throughout their time, the various stories, which I think work well. And why can't they add more of that? Not so that they're, you know, drooling over each other all the time.
Mm.
And something I'm going to come on to as well, that I think this series is possibly Murray Gold's finest hour. Closing music, as this is all happening, and Rory kills Amy. And it all goes to hell. And I initially I was a bit disappointed with the Big Bang because the sheer nonsense of all the timey-wimey stuff, you know, the paradox. But the sheer nonsense of it all overrides the illogicality of it. It doesn't really make sense. It may make logical sense in temporal theory. It doesn't really make dramatic and emotional sense.
Yeah.
For the Doctor to be out of the Pandorica without... It's a bit like, you know, when the Moffat makes the angels in his first story almost unbeatable. So he has to introduce them. To make them work again, he has to introduce this thing where, oh, you can fool them into thinking you're looking at them. And that what Neil Gaiman did with the Cybermen, making them super fast and able to upgrade like that. And you think, how are they going to work that again? Because you've made them almost unbeatable. But having left us at the end of Pandorica with this, we can't think how the Doctor gets out of this thing. Well, he only does it by really just cheating, really. A bit like Fenric. Suddenly realizing after hundreds of years of studying this chessboard in his mind, oh, I win by cheating. Oh, that worked.
Yeah.
But so much that nice thing of the different cyber threat. It's just, you know, a head with tentacles attacking Amy. Rory the Auton Centurion, the Doctor ignoring him. And then coming back and just prodding him. That's. Can you remember at what point we twigged that the Pandorica was meant for him?
The actual moment, I think.
Yeah, it wasn't until the very end for me.
Yeah, no, because they give us a bit of a feint, don't they? In that the Doctor says the story is that there's a you know, the most dangerous living creature in there, and you do think perhaps that's the Doctor, and he's saying, yeah, you know, a trickster, a warrior and stuff, who's been put in this, trapped in this box, so the legend goes, and he was trapped in it by a good wizard. And you immediately think, of course, the Doctor's the good wizard, and River even says that. So, do you know what I mean? It distracts you and says, oh, he's the good wizard.
But as Hayden said, that bit where the Doctor is talking about little Amelia's bedside when she's asleep is another of those moments that, like Parting of the Ways, you know, I wanted you safe, my Doctor. Like, I still can't believe that I cry at You're My Daddy in Father's Day, which ought to be the most cringeworthy line ever in Doctor Who, except it fills me up with tears every time I hear it. What's the one I've just mentioned? Kazran at the end of Christmas Carol. But this, oh, that whole, I think I'll skip the rerun, I hate repeats. And he reaches over and kisses her. Oh, God, I don't believe it. I'm welling up now. Early last night, I was typing up some rough notes I'd written. I was trying to remember. Does he say, bye-bye, Pond, live well, love Rory? Is the other way around? I just remembering the words, I started crying again. And it always happens. And it's partly Matt's acting and partly the music that's going with it.
And the dialogue, obviously, as well. It's going to be a big part of that, yeah.
I don't belong here anymore. I think I'll skip the rest of the rewind. I hate repeats. Live well. Love Rory. Bye bye, Bob.
And I even love the something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue.
Yeah, and also when they climb on board the ship, climb aboard the TARDIS, and she says, we haven't snogged in the shrubbery yet, or something. And it's, that's a bit of a, I can't help thinking a lot of times when Moffat's writing this era, that he's just not getting enough at home. It's like blue ball writing, isn't it? He's just so total. It seems.
Mark!
Well,
I thought you meant it then. I thought you meant he was writing with a blue ballpoint pen. And he dropped.
It's like he's so horny when he's writing all the time. It's like just, you know, he just needs a cup of bromide tea or whatever. And a cold shower, I think, before we start script writing sometimes. And it would avoid a lot of this trouble.
So that was second for me, third for Mark. No points from Hayden because he's got no taste whatsoever.
Nope. Appalling taste in everything myself.
Vincent?
Oh, yes. Yeah, now this is one that, again, production-wise, apparently was a first draft by Richard Curtis, and then pretty much the rest of it was a Stephen Moffat script.
Mm.
And I think it kind of stands out there on its own a little bit in this era, because it is talking, again, it's adult themes, but done well, I think, whereas Let's Kill Hitler was the aftermath of an adult theme presented horrendously. I think this time it works really well. The Tony Curran likeness to Vincent van Gogh is astonishing. Really, that moment when he holds the painting up and the likeness is there. And he's excellent as Vincent van Gogh. I love the way that the Scottish accent is described here as being Dutch. and the way that they worked his famous paintings into the scene. And even having a song by Athlete, a really boring indie band, at the moment when he sees what happens to his art in the future and gives him a little ray of hope, even though he only lives another year. Brilliant moment. Bill Nighy isn't even credited for his appearance. Did anyone else notice that? He's not in the credits.
Yeah, I didn't notice that.
But no, he isn't given a thing. But he's a nice addition too. I think we'd all like to know that, you know, what we do or what we strive to do will be worth it in the end. You know, to be given that little glimmer is wondrous.
Yeah, I think one of the best lines in it is the one about you've got a pile of bad things and a pile of good things.
Absolutely.
We didn't make a difference at all.
I wouldn't say that. The way I see it, every life is a pile of good things and bad things. Hey,
the good things don't always soften the bad things, but vice versa, the bad things don't necessarily spoil the good things or make them unimportant. And we definitely added to his pile.
Yeah, I think it's a really affecting story. And again, it could be one that could easily have got into my top five.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's glorious. I love that story. And then, yeah, then The 11th Hour, which I still think to this day is the best introduction story for a Doctor. And it was kind of instant.
Ever,
yeah. And I think there was such a pressure coming after David Tennant. David Tennant?
David Tennant, as written by Terry Nation.
Yeah, there was such big pressure off the David Tennant era and Russell T Davis leaving that this really had to work, kind of on a level that we haven't seen again. Well, possibly with Jodie, of course.
Mm.
But it was huge, and I just remember breathing a huge sigh of relief that they'd made it work.
Yeah.
With a brilliant first story, even from the moment when he pops up from the title, says, "Can I have an apple?" Right from then, I thought, yes, he's got this. He's got this in the bag. Because I always felt, and this was kind of one of the reasons why I don't like the Tennant era, is because it was put on such a pedestal. And towards the end of that era, even in the show, they were making it sound as though nothing will ever beat this. And there was a moment I remember watching The Confidential on New Year's Day to The End of Time when Stephen Moffat comes and sits in, and I could almost feel the boos of fandom, be like, you know,
the booze that you've been drinking.
Well, I probably had done, to be honest, on New Year's Day, but there we are. I just felt as though there was a collective sigh of relief from fandom that it worked. Then with these two unknowns in the companion and the doctor role, and right from the off, it was great. The story was excellent, rather simple, and the Atraxi are a fairly effective villain, even though they're off screen for most of it.
Yeah.
I thought the comedy was great. I thought the interaction between the characters was excellent. And it all culminated, of course, in that scene on the rooftop. And I just remember sitting there aghast when you hear that. When you got the holograms coming, I thought, oh, yeah, no, this. I was completely.
Yeah, goosebumps.
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. And even the quieter scenes towards the end when he does take Amy in the TARDIS. Ooh, pardon? talk about interspecies relationships in Doctor Who. No, even then, like seeing that TARDIS for the first time, even though it was clearly a bit mad and a bit like the inside of a Nando's, it still worked. And I, Yeah, I just loved it, and I still do. I think it's a brilliant episode.
Yeah, I think it showcased Matt Smith's charm and charisma as an actor. And it just, yeah, I immediately warmed to him. I didn't expect to, having seen photos of him in his, you know, tight jeans and his kind of slightly emo, floppy hair.
Do you remember that? Oh, it's the emo doctor.
Yeah, and thinking, oh.
We almost decided not to like him.
Yeah. He was great when he came in. He seemed to be brilliant straight off the bat. I've got a huge affection for his portrayal of the Doctor, whatever you think about the stories. I really do. So Matt Smith's one of my favourite Doctors. I just think his acting's great. It's non-stop as well. He's almost constantly moving. It's such a sort of kinetic performance. He's constantly going, twiddling things and twirling things around, but not in a way that irritates me. It's just, it all seems to be, and that seems to bleed through to whole pace, I'd say, for most of Matt Smith's era. I don't think any of the stories, no matter how bad they were, I ever thought were as dull as, Fear Her or anything. You know, stories always seem to be fairly quickly paced. And it just seems to carry you, they just carry you through on momentum. And I love that part as a person.
Yeah, me too.
Well, if you want to go and make yourself a drink for a while before I start, because you, Mark, you put 11th Hour in fifth place. It's ashamed of yourself. Hayden, you put it in second place. I put it in first place. And if you'll allow me, I'll go on about it a little, because I'm going to tie into my general ideas about the era, really, because it was a bit of a shocker for me rewatching this era, because I've always thought about Tom and then maybe Chris and possibly Matt as maybe some of my top three Doctors. And then I rewatched this and I realised that since their first broadcast, the only episodes of Matt Smith I've ever rewatched, Christmas Carol and Day of the Doctor aside, are ones from the first series, series 5.
Snap.
And because I love those so much, I think it's coloured my opinion of him, because I'm afraid that for most of the rest of his era, I just don't like this era at all. This is the best introduction of any Doctor. The idea of introducing a new Doctor through the eyes of a child 12 years before she actually becomes his companion is wonderful. And even more wonderful, it's done skillfully. But the essence of Doctor Who, as far as I'm concerned, is the doctor-child relationship, which is very much not an adult-child relationship, because the Doctor's a childlike figure himself. And although the Doctor is coming along to take on the role of a grown-up sorting out the problem of the crack in Amelia's wall, they subvert that adult role with the Doctor falling over. That's where Amelia constantly being put in situations where she's asking, "Are you all right?" The whole fish fingers and custard scene, which, let's face it, is Tom putting on different costumes at the start of Robot, isn't it? Amelia is the child in need of help, but she's been put in the role of a carer towards the Doctor, asking if he's all right, cooking food for him. And that's what I mean about the notion of a doctor-child relationship. It can be easy to think of that as being the child hiding behind the sofa, the Doctor turning up as an alien god to save the day. But for me, it ought to be a relationship where we as the child are scared for the safety of the Doctor, not scared for the safety of mankind or the universe. Tom Baker tells that story, doesn't he? When he's in his day, he'd visit schools and children would come and whisper up in his ear advice on how to escape from the Daleks.
Yeah.
Because they were worried about him. That's what used to worry me. Not that the Daleks would conquer the universe, but they'd hurt the Doctor or Sarah. So you get these regular instances of the Doctor being childlike. Not childish, childlike. I don't even have an aunt. You're lucky. Yeah, no, I am. Everything's going to be fine. And there are moments where just before, I mean, I didn't actually burst to tears at all during this story, but there are moments where I'm just goggle-eyed at how good it is. Just before he opens the crack in the wall, he reaches out to take Amelia's hand. And it's a two-way thing. He's both offering reassurance to her and seeking reassurance from her. Yeah. That's a beautifully realised thing. I don't know if it's possible in the current era, with everything being so serious, with Graham having cancer, and Yaz being intense and resenting the Doctor for having been in prison. I actually find it extraordinary that in a show like Doctor Who, which is supposed to be an escapist experience for children, they thought it would be appropriate to have one of the doctor's friends having cancer. But there's that other famous story, you know, where Tom gets stopped on Oxford Street by a man who'd been in a children's home.
Oh, yeah.
Quite often, even now, not long ago, I was walking in Oxford Street and a man stopped and he said, Tom Baker? And I said, yeah. He said, Tom Baker, Christ. And I'm used to this. And I saw he was rather touched. He said, you know, and as he looked at me, I could see him being catapulted back somewhere. And he said, do you know, when I was a kid, I was in a home, you know, in North Wales, and they didn't, it wasn't very good. They didn't like us, you know, nobody wanted us. And you made Saturday night good for us, you know? And I said, I could see his face. And I went to speak, and he said, and squeezed my arm, and he was gone, you know? Now, to make a little speech to an old man in Oxford Street, 30-odd years later, showed, you know, the power, didn't it, of a benevolent character on children.
Now, imagine if those children today were getting their one escapist treat of the week and they're being presented with one of the doctor's friends dying of cancer. Mm. It's all summed up for me by little Amelia in a nightdress and her wellies, sitting on a little suitcase in the garden and waiting.
Oh, yeah. Just want to say, Angels Take Manhattan, when they cut back to that scene, my mum was in fits of tears on the broadcast of that bit.
Yes, exactly.
When they cut back to her going back in the garden with her wellies and the... Yeah, it makes me well up thinking about it, actually. Yeah.
A lonely child's faith in the Doctor sums up what the show was for a lot of children. And why, to a lot of us, the question, if you don't like it, why do you keep watching it, will always be silly. And they get it right as well. Imagine if the child playing Amelia, who was Karen Gillan's cousin, wasn't she? Had been selected from the Nightmare in Silver genre of children. And that is why, and this is why I didn't mention this earlier, but that's why at the end of the Angels 2-parter, Amy jumping the Doctor and trying to have sex with him was so ill-judged. Her relationship with the Doctor, it was founded in meeting him as a child, and it was thought appropriate to sexualise that and to have her be, not only that, sexualise that, but to have her betraying Rory on the eve of their wedding. Her relationship with the Doctor is supposed to be one of trust, not lust.
Yeah, I mean, I hate that moment, but the only thing that rescues that slightly for me is the fact that Stephen Moffat came out and said, I was wrong to do that.
Yeah.
That is the only redeemable feature to that bit for me. Sorry, I just wanted to bring that in.
Yeah, I also mentioned about that earlier, didn't I?
Mm.
Anyway, it's the introduction of the new Doctor. Yeah. The bit that sells him in the role for me is when he races downstairs, stop the TARDIS blowing up, and he's sitting on the edge of the door, about to jump in with Geronimo, and he pauses to look back over his shoulder at Amelia with a little nervous smile that contains, oh, so much reassurance, nervousness, excitement. And I thought, that's the moment I thought, oh my God, this is a decent actor.
Yeah.
The moment where Amy runs upstairs to pack her little suitcase, and as she's running back and forth across the landing, the door at the end of the landing is suddenly ajar. I very nearly soiled myself when I first saw that. Love the whole Ledworth thing. I think our own Matt Charlton once said that the village green and full of all these eccentric characters makes it far more like The Prisoner than the sort of metropolitan settings of the previous four series. Mm. I like how all the villagers have clearly known Amy from childhood and have very little problem with her eccentricities because they're half of as barking as she is. And I love how that you start realising that they're all steeped in the story of the Raggedy Doctor. You have a succession of people saying, oh my God, it's him. But one of the greatest things is the fabulous incidental music from Murray Gold. That sort of xylophone-like music for Amelia. So fairy tale. And the pum-pum-pum-pum-pum-pum-pum thing for the Doctor. Last thing I'm going to say is, she goes out into the garden with that big red torch and the white head. And it may just have been chosen to match her white nightie and her red cardigan and red wellies. But that was exactly the same torch we had at my family home since the early 1970s, on a shelf under the stairs. And you see it out of the corner of your eye whenever you went to fetch a coat. Foundational childhood memory for me. So sorry to go on a bit, but that's me.
And then we had Dave.
Day of the Doctor.
Do you know what? I kind of feel like we should come back to this as an actual episode.
Yeah.
Oh, that's an idea. Day, you mean?
Yeah, Day, because there's that's so much idea to talk about in there. Maybe we should do that later on in the year, but because it's fantastic. Mm. I Mark even said it earlier, and he likes the Nymon.
I know.
That it's one of the greatest Doctor Who stories ever. I think it deserves a podcast of its own.
Yep.
Great stuff. It's funny, isn't it, how it can be the centre of your life at the time, but 10 years later, you've largely forgotten it, or it seems old-fashioned. Do you remember how we were all fascinated by the fact that Rory's NHS badge was dated 1990?
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
there's clearly some point as to why there are no ducks in the duck pond. What can it be?
The Doctor had his jacket back on when he went back to speak to Amy in time.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant.
And
yeah.
People go, oh, yeah, continuity error. And everyone going, yes, we spotted that too. It's like, yeah, and it's actually a plot point. It's lovely.
Do we have a stat breakdown for each series?
Well, funny you should ask that, because right at the bottom of the spreadsheet, yes, we do.
Hooray! My favourite bit.
I don't know if it's worth asking you to guess which series came top.
Would it be 5?
Well, for instance, actually, if you take... I've got it split out here as series 5, 6 and 7. But then Time of the Doctor and Day of the Doctor really came almost as a separate series, didn't they? They came right at the end of... So I've almost got that as series 8. I suppose they're two specials, aren't they?
Yeah, but, I suppose a series... Going back to what I said about the doping.
Like, yeah, financial doping.
7 stats have been seriously pumped up by Day of the Doctor and possibly Time of the Doctor.
I think we expected that Matt's first series, Series 5, would be top, and it was, with out of 1,080 total votes, it gained 436, which is 40%.
Mm.
Next came Series 6. Which gained 243 votes in total, which is 23% of the total. And next came Series 7, which is 184 points, which is 17%. And then the Day of the Doctor, Time of the Doctor finale gained 217 points, which is 20%. So it's actually got more votes than the whole of Series 7. But that's surprising, really, when you consider the Day of the Doctor.
So I suppose if we're saying that Day of the Doctor is part of Series 7, which is tenuous...
That would take it up to 37%.
Right, okay.
So Series 5 would be 40, Series 7 would be 37, and Series 6 would be 23.
Right,
so,
okay.
So take it however you like, listeners. And then, of course, we always have to look at whose votes most accurately reflected those of the community. So, given that each person had 15 points to assign, did anyone manage to get all of their 15 points in the top 5? Mm. Well, of course, no one did. Let's see. A few people got 13. That Rick Moran.
Up the irons.
Who's that?
West Ham.
I know where I am with an iron.
The Jim Smith. James Curry Smith. Oh, guess who else got a 13? Who do we know whose views are so... They're just not rebellious at all. It's that Hayden again. Got 13 points.
Yay.
I got 9. Someone, I can't read the name. Only got 4. That was you, Mark.
Yes. I'm surprised, actually, because I thought I'd... I know Hayden was expecting me to go over some rank outsiders, as I occasionally do, but
yeah.
I thought that I'd gone for pretty...
Well, Time of Angels, Flesh and Stone, was at which you gave 5 points to, only just came outside at number 6.
Yes, what's let me down.
Yeah. But the top one we've got is Paul Starkey at Luna_Werewolf. Congratulations to Paul. There we are then. So, Hayden, have you got your hat to pick out the next Doctor Zero we're going to choose?
I have indeed. It's in the nappy holder that we've got underneath the... Because it's the only... I threw out my Trilby hat over Christmas, so... Okay. Right, here we go. Pulling it out now. Okay, this is actually a bit of a godsend, because we've gone from an era where there's a high number of episodes, and now we're going to an era where there's barely any at all. In fact, you could argue there's only really one story in this person's era. Got Paul McGann.
I think...
Come on.
Our retrospective is going to just have to be a review of the...
The TV movie, isn't it? Yeah.
No, seriously, is that what we do?
That's what I've just got.
So, send in your top one Paul McGann...
Yeah, please contact us on social media with the phrase "the TV movie."
Why don't we do the because it's a TV movie. It's just a one off. Let's just do our own Eighth Doctor experience. And let me pull another name out of the hat to do the next one when we ask people.
For okay.
Go on. Yeah. Hang on. Right. Okay. Oh yes. Brilliant. Okay. We've got John Pertwee.
Oh, bloody hell! That's another three months I have to spend rewatching that.
No, that's easy for me. I don't need to rewatch them.
Yeah, I've watched many of those recently. So yeah.
Let's just finish off with some readers' correspondence, shall we? Dan Talks Doctor Who says this exercise led me to a shocking conclusion. I loved Matt Smith's Doctor, but I don't actually like many of the stories from his era. 42 to Doomsday Boys said, "Let's Kill Hitler" has to be the worst. David Kitchen said, "The Matt Smith era is the period I stopped watching Doctor Who for a time, although the 50th anniversary lured me back in soon enough. But that does make it hard to pick a top five I really like. I think Smith himself is a very talented actor, but as he quickly develops into the manic and silly, coupled with scripts full of the worst of the wanky and cringe worship of the Doctor, giving long, ponderous speeches about his awesomeness, he ended up as my least favourite Doctor." I must say, it was the how he morphed into the jabbering, "I love Fezzes, Fezzes are cool, I love Fezzes," foreseeing the way they start writing Jodie, and the way he started becoming such a shouty actor in his later series, which I think was foreseen by his speech on top of Stonehenge shouting at the ships. Kevin Jordan replied to David Kitchen's message saying, "It's really interesting how different Doctors hit a chord with different viewers. Smith was my favourite Doctor since Tom Baker." And Dave replied, "Absolutely, I can totally see why he would be for a lot of fans. It just didn't work for me. But that's the strength of the show. So many people take different things from it." Then Kevin Jordan came back with, "Dave Kitchen is just one of the hashtag Smithies not my Doctor hate brigade. This shows how fandom these days is full of nothing but haters." Dave says, "Get your war machine off my lawn, Jordan, and stop threatening my right to free speech." Anyway, it wasn't me, it was Antifa. Oh no, hang on, those last two bits I just made up. No, sir. Deborah, a flightless crow, says, "Maybe it sounds silly, but Vincent and the Doctor changed the way I looked at my own mental health. The God Complex is one of the most layered stories written for the show. Day of the Doctor feels like a cheat, but I'd be lying not to add it to a top five. And I can put The Lodger on any time and it still makes me laugh, even if it doesn't make any sense." And Johnny Dab says, "I like Matt Smith as the Doctor. I like the way Matt's Doctor is fun, jovial, clever, and he's also such a hero. In some of these stories, he represents what's truly great about Doctor Who. Unfortunately, I don't really like his era." "I found most of the storyline shallow. Loads of grandeur and posturing." It's a flip of the coin. "But no substance or considered conclusions. They seem to always try and use obvious cheap tricks to solve or create plotting twists. I'm looking at you, Pandorica Opens the Big Bang. Also, I found characters like Amy River and Clara create incredibly vapid and irritating. When they just retconned a character in, who was never there at the beginning, just to solve the Amy pregnant thing, it felt like a big pile of steaming dingo's kidneys. So out of 39 stories, there are 8 good ones, 18 which are average to just about okay, and then 13 stories which are just toe-curlingly dire." Right.
Oh, fair enough.
Oh, who's coming here? Uncle Terence, how are you? Have you got a bit of sage advice to give us?
Yes, he said, "Don't throw bodies into the river."
Uncle Terence, we have enemy ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.
Is that saging as in sage advisor to the government?
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us
at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting. Fit it in your ear.